All right, Mr. Maketa.
Thank you, Ms. Chief Justice. May it please the court. What I'd like to do is start with the issue that we started with in our briefing and that we repeated at the end of every argument in our briefing and that we ended up with in our briefing and that was never rebutted in the reply that was filed on Friday. And that is that everything complained of, if it were true, is rendered moot by the legislative choice of a trial de novo, as in cases from justice to county court. There was no rebuttal to that in the written papers Friday. Perhaps there will be comments on that in the final 15 minutes today. An important part of that is the question of whether the order was void, and I want to address the word void. But if the action was not void, then everything complained about is solved by the legislative choice, good or bad, that there be a trial de novo in these circumstances.
And so what is your thought of how a trial de novo would be held by this court?
Yes. My thought, by the book, is that this would happen. The three of you would sit in an evidentiary trial receiving evidence.
So we would hear all the same evidence that was presented before Judge Bershelman, I think is how you say it.
All the evidence that either Mr. Babcock or I chose to bring at that hearing, which could duplicate. There could easily be, by agreement, a presentation of any parts of that transcript that could be read as you read things in your appellate review, but offered into evidence, still calling if Mr. Babcock wished to recall a witness live or I wish to call live. That could be the method and have a much more expedited trial. But the trial de novo are words that you're very familiar with, and they mean that the next tribunal, classically the county court at law, sometimes the district court in certain administrative matters, but that the special court that's appointed here hears evidence and makes its choices from the new record, just as if no old record existed unless it's offered into evidence before you.
And Mr. Maketa, and frankly, it doesn't sound fair. And maybe fair isn't written in all of this. It doesn't sound fair and it doesn't feel fair that you can have somebody face an entire trial before a fact finder, then just you do a do-over. So she has to pay her lawyer all the expense to do it all over again, pay the citizens, pay another fact finder to do it all over again. It doesn't sound fair and it doesn't feel fair for whatever that's worth. And maybe it's worth nothing, but that's the way it feels to me.
And I'm sympathetic with that. That is, even those of us paid a dollar have fully amortized that dollar, Your Honor. I'm sympathetic with that and wish that legislature had made different policy choices. You could picture a legislative choice saying, if there's a formal proceeding, we have this kind of review. If there's not, we have this kind.
That's what the Constitution says. It says you get to do your investigation, and then you can issue a sanction if it's appropriate.
Yes.
Or you can institute a formal hearing and formal proceedings. And he said there's no dispute it was a formal hearing and a formal proceeding.
Yes.
And I don't think you're
That's
disputing
correct.
That.
That's correct. Not disputed.
So if you went under the or part, and then you were limited to the censure or the other things. And so how do you reconcile that? I know you've pulled isolated a few parts of that section, but when you read the totality of the section, it sure doesn't seem like you have the option of a sanction after a formal hearing or a formal proceeding.
Thank you, Justice Alcala. Let me try to address that in two ways. One is as if I were a grammarian talking about the word or. One is talking about the last sentence of that provision, which I know that you've read. It's the one that says, if there's a finding of good cause, therefore, for censure or removal, then two outcomes, a recommendation or a censure. It doesn't say what happens otherwise. It doesn't take away anything. It doesn't say that the other option is dismissal, although that's a fair reading that that's one permissible outcome. But it doesn't say that the other outcomes specified in this Constitution are no longer available. And the Supreme Court, 18 years ago, reading this constitutional provision, adopted Rule 10M, which expressly says that a permissible outcome after Rule 10 formal proceedings expressly says is a warning, reprimand, or others. That's Rule 10M, adopted by the Supreme Court 18 years ago. For 15 years, the Supreme Court Advisory Committee has had among its members Mr. Babcock. He has chaired, is now the chair, has chaired that for the last 10 years, and nobody has ever said that that is wrong. When the Constitution was amended in 2005, nothing was done to say, no, that's wrong. When the statutes have been amended from time to time, nothing to say, no, that's wrong. So one point is, look at the last sentence, which prescribes outcomes if there's a certain kind of finding and doesn't take away any other, doesn't specify or take away other outcomes. But I want to be a grammarian also, if I may.
Well, wait a second. I have one question.
Thank you.
The Constitution itself, at the end of that section or article, section 14, says that the legislature's laws are not to be inconsistent with these constitutional provisions. So regardless of whether the legislature did it or the Supreme Court did it, aren't both of those entities bound by that restriction?
No question. Even if that didn't say that, nobody's allowed by statute or rulemaking to violate the Constitution. And the question is that a reasonable construction of the Constitution? So I want to be a grammarian for a few minutes. The word or. We all have used the word or to sometimes mean either A or B, but not both. Sometimes to mean A or B or both. And when we just see A or B, one of the things you as justices do from time to time is construe where a phrase can mean any of several things. Do we have guidance? So what I did is I looked at the first place in our Constitution that the word or appears. I just wanted to see. And in Article 1, Section 2, it's not briefed, it's just it's in everybody's Constitution. Article 1, Section 2, at the very beginning of the Texas Constitution, there's the inherent power of the people, the inalienable right to alter, reform, or abolish their government, the people's government. Well, does that mean if on one occasion they reform it, they no longer have the power to later alter or abolish it? That word or in that provision clearly is not an exclusive or. Then I listened to Mr. Babcock today talk about a paragraph that's not been briefed by him or me, but he discussed it today, and I read it, and it has the word or in it. It's Article 5, Section 1A, so it's our umbrella of things. Paragraph 10, it's the one where he said that, he said examiner, that's the wrong word, but he meant executive director in that, that the executive director can say certain things. Well, it doesn't exactly say that. It says the executive director or its chairman can say certain things. Does that mean if the executive director has talked, the chairman cannot talk? Of course not. That's an and or. That's an A or B or both. So we look in paragraph 8. Do we find guidance that the Constitution intends, unlike these other uses of the word or, that this is either A or B, but not both? That is, Justice Alcala, I'm going on further than you're ready.
Well, no, yeah. I hear you. Okay. And I've read that section many times, trying to figure out, is this illustrative or is it exhaustive?
Yes.
And I can see that there's another, perhaps, point of view. But I'm looking at, and I don't know what the formal title for this, but it's in Appendix K of Mr. Babcock's motion to dismiss, and it's the rules?
Yes, those are the rules promulgated by the Texas Supreme Court.
Okay, so let's look at Rule 1, definition for sanction.
No question, under this rule.
Okay, and let me read it because it's a pretty big deal to me. It says sanction, which is what this is. A sanction is remedial in nature. It is issued prior to the institution of formal proceedings to deter similar misconduct by a judge or judges in the future, to promote proper administration of justice, and to reassure the public that the judicial system of this state neither permits or condones misconduct. That says a sanction comes prior to the initiation of formal proceedings, but yet you just disregard that and you issued a sanction after formal proceedings. What do we do with that?
Thank you. That's an important question, and I want to be very clear because I want to go in two parts of this answer. One is to compare the definition of sanction in the government code dealing with this appeal. The other is to look at Rule 10M, where what the commission issued for terminology of the rules is called a warning. So I want to walk through both directions. I just wanted to preview the two directions. There are two authors, one of the statute by the legislature and one of the Supreme Court, the rules. And they define the word sanction differently. And they use it, and wherever it's used in the rules, we ought to look back to what you just read, absolutely. And every time we see the word sanction in the rules, including Rule 9 review, every time we see the word sanction in the rules, we need to say it's that definition now being used. And every time we see the word sanction in the rules, it's a pre-formal proceeding thing. But wait a minute. Let's look at Rule 10M. So I'm still at tab K. I'm now in tab K back at page 7. 10M is where it says, and Rule 10 is all about formal proceedings. That's what Rule 10 deals with from start to finish. It's formal proceedings. So Rule 10M,
we're would you agree that Rule 10M is the only provision that appears to allow the commission to issue a sanction after a formal hearing?
Your Honor, I almost agree that it's not a sanction if we use the definition under the rules. It's a warning. You see that in Rule 10M, they don't use the word sanction because it has a special pre-formal proceeding meaning in the rules. They spell out reprimand, warning, admonition. They don't use the word sanction because, Justice Alcala, you're exactly right. In the rules, a sanction has a specified pre-formal proceeding meaning. And that's why the Supreme Court in Rule 10M doesn't say at the end of a formal proceeding you can issue a sanction, because that's specially defined in the rules. It says you can do a recommendation of removal or retirement, or a censure, reprimand, warning, or admonition. Those are the words from the statute, from the constitutional paragraph, and the Supreme Court, rightly or wrongly, construed the Constitution as authorizing warning before or after formal proceedings.
And that's the provision that the commission was relying upon when they issued the public warning?
It was. It was cited. There's a portion of it that was outdated in 2005. That is, now that I'm not talking about the word warning or any word sanction. In 2005, the people of Texas amended the Constitution, so there are now 13 members instead of 11 on the commission. And the Supreme Court and its Rules Advisory Committee have not yet updated, so it still says you need 6 votes. Crystal clear, you need 7. Here, every indication from that order is that it was unanimous. The suggestion that it was 6 is on wild speculation, but I've drifted.
Isn't that set out in the order? That it
was
a vote of 6?
No, it didn't say any head count. It said we, the commission, and it signed it by the chair of the commission, just as when you have unanimous decisions from a court of appeals, there may be an identity of the panel, but doesn't say, and so held Justice Jones and Justice Smith. Everything one can tell from that order is this was unanimous. There is no hint, no evidence of anything contrary.
Well, counsel, on page 19 of the order, I quote, it says, pursuant to the authority contained in Article 5, Section 1-A8 of the Texas Constitution, the commission issues the public warning, not based on Rule 10M.
Then I misspoke, because I believe that 10M was also cited there, and I apologize, Justice Krager. Right. But I do believe that the power has to be from the Constitution. I do believe that the Supreme Court has given a reasonable construction of that provision. And now let's kind of think, what is the outcome? I'm supporting the view, as the Supreme Court has done for 18 years, that a warning is a permissible outcome under the Constitution after formal proceedings. That is, it is almost nonsensical that you could give extra process to somebody but take away the leniency available if you find they acted wrong, but it should be
lenient. Aren't they saying that the public censure and the removal and retirement is the, it should be saved for the most egregious conduct of an elected official?
It says that there's more process given, so that the greater process that comes from formal proceedings is triggered before those are eligible outcomes. Nothing says those are the only outcomes from a formal proceeding. The Supreme Court's construction of the Constitution says there are these that are eligible. Mr. Babcock, of course, says one outcome unspecified in the Constitution is dismissal. I agree. But that proves that the last sentence has outcomes that are not specified there. And nothing in that last sentence takes away these other more lenient outcomes.
But look at also the same thing, the Texas Supreme Court rules, and it's rule 9D.
Yes.
Decision by the special court of review may include dismissal, affirmation of the commission's decision, imposition of a lesser or greater sanction, or order to the commission to file formal proceedings. Doesn't that then presume that there never was formal proceedings, that it was just this investigatory thing by the commission, so that there was never a formal proceeding, and so now it can come to us, and then we can order that formal proceedings take place? So I don't see how you can logically reconcile your argument with the phrasing in D.
You may recall in my briefing, and perhaps it was not very prominent, we do not believe Rule 9 applies to this proceeding. I want to talk about the statute that does apply to this proceeding. Okay. Because I do think Rule 9 is for appeals of sanctions as defined in the rules. Sanctions as defined in the rules are pre-formal proceeding outcomes. So I think Rule 9, including Rule 9D, comes from something that's defined in the rules. The Supreme Court promulgated this method. The legislature promulgated a different statute. It was amended in part several years ago after the In Re Genovine case. The legislature, and this is on tab H of the same volume that we're looking at, this. The legislature has a statute, and it used a different definition. And if we look at the definition, and one of the things that we criticized in Judge Keller's briefing was that she uses the rule definition to construe the statute, and we think that's mistaken. We think when you're construing a statute, you look to the definitions that the legislature adopted within that statute. So if we look, does everybody have the tab H available? That's where the statute is, and it was a convenient, I appreciated the appendix that Judge Keller's counsel provided. If we look on the second page, paragraph 10 defines sanction with no reference to whether it is pre or post formal proceeding. It's silent as to that. And then when we get to the appellate parts, and that's on pages 18 and subsequent, it applies if there is an appeal of a sanction, but here we have to, every time we see sanction in the statute, we need to use the definition in the statute. And Justice Alcala, that's why I briefed that Rule 9 is not the process that brings us here today, although a very similar statute brings us here today. Because I agree with your reading, Justice Alcala, that in the rules, when we see the word sanction, It's an outcome of pre-formal. And that's why Rule 10M says post-formal, the same thing, warning, is not called a sanction, it's called a warning. But in the statute, sanction does not limit it to being pre-formal. And on page 18, under the review procedures, if the judge wishes to appeal, nobody requires her to appeal. Nobody requires her to appeal. If she wishes to appeal, if it's a sanction or a censure, this statute applies. I want to go back to the Chief Justice's comment in an earlier part of argument. The Constitution is silent on these things. These are legislative choices. The Constitution has one review mechanism, not applicable here. If there were a recommendation of removal or retirement, the Commission does not order removal and does not order retirement. The Constitution says a 7-justice, and I've on one occasion 8 years ago represented the Commission for another dollar in a removal proceeding and faced 7 justices here. Well, I shared some with Ms. Alcala, so I have $1. That's the only constitutional review. Otherwise, when this outcome came, there is no constitutional review specified. It is a matter of legislative grace, and we've cited how it's the case law that itself would not be a due process violation, but I'm a fan, many of us would be fans, that there be some review, and the legislature said, let's have review.
I mean to interrupt you, but I'm going back to what you said about, you say we should apply Chapter 33 of the Government Code.
034. Yes, 33.034.
Okay, and I'm looking at that Chapter 33, and I'm looking at definitions.
Yes.
And then the definition for formal proceedings,
yes,
which is number 7, means the proceedings ordered by the Commission concerning the public censure, removal, or retirement of a judge.
Yes.
Doesn't that then presume that those are, isn't that consistent with the interpretation that the Constitution authorizes censure or the seeking of removal or retirement of a judge in a formal proceeding? It doesn't include sanction or something other than those three things.
It doesn't say what are the outcomes. It says, I read it as saying, ordered concerning those items, that is, the Constitution says before those items can be on the table, there must be more process given than otherwise. Nothing here says the proceedings concerning dismissal of all charges, but surely that's a permissible outcome from formal proceedings. Nothing here says that formal proceedings are limited to these outcomes. Nothing. This is the process required by the Constitution before there's the potential for these outcomes. Nothing in the Constitution, nothing in the statute, takes away more lenient outcomes. That is, if somebody done something wrong and the Commission wants to see what's the extent of it, and after listening to all of it decides this does not warrant removal, this does not warrant censure as defined in the statute, which is defining a constitutional word, but it warrants saying, don't do this again. Nothing in the Constitution says you can't find, you acted improperly, don't do it again, merely because we've given more process than otherwise. The more lenient, nothing takes away the more lenient, and the Supreme Court, as I've said too many times, 18 years ago, never changing it afterwards, has consistently over that time said one possible outcome is a warning, is a reprimand. And they don't use the word sanction because that's in the rules that have a specialized definition.
I have another question then.
Thank you, Justice Alcala. I'm very grateful, both Mr. Babcock and I, to know what are the issues that need attention and yes.
Part of it just doesn't make any sense again. If, in fact, you have a censure, which is worse than a sanction, a review of a censure is by a record. But a review of a sanction, which is a lower punishment, would be a trial de novo. It doesn't make any sense. You would think it would be the exact opposite, that if it's the higher one, you get a de novo review because it's a more significant impact on the person. But if it's a sanction, you would be limited to a review of the record, like a traffic ticket. Well, I guess that's not a good example. But the point is that you would think that a censure would be a de novo and a sanction would be a review of the record. And the only way it makes any sense to me then is that a sanction can't come after a formal proceeding.
Now, remember that the Constitution specifies the court for the most severe removal or retirement, and it's not a new trial. It's a hearing from the evidence that was developed below. It's not a new trial. So I would agree with you that if I were in the legislature, asked what would be good policy, I might say I'd like to have lots of deferential things like we do in the administrative code. If I were in the legislature, I might want to do a distinction. Was there a formal proceeding or not? If I were in the legislature, there are a lot of choices that I might want to make as to what this should be. But I must say, Justice Alcala, with regret that they have not given the deferential review here, I think that the words in the statute are unambiguous in 33034, that this, for statutory purposes, a warning is a sanction, and then under Part E, that it is de novo. I wish that weren't so.
Would it be a reasonable interpretation, though, that they said, as from a justice court to a county court, that instead of looking at the sentence or the punishment, we look to the due process concerns and the sanction contemplated an informal investigation and a less formal hearing, whereas a censure provided for greater due process and a more formal hearing, therefore you only have an appellate review, whereas a sanction, if it was as intended, I believe, as has been referenced here, to be a pre-formal hearing warning or sanction of some sort, at that point you would have the more thorough trial de novo, where you have a right to confront your witnesses and put on evidence.
Yes, and the problem is that the legislature said for a warning, a sanction warning, we have a method. And here, the Supreme Court rule is very clear. I argue in brief and urge and believe, consistent with a reasonable reading of the Constitution, a warning is an outcome that can come after all that process. The legislature, instead of demarking formal and non-formal, demarked an outcome. I wish it hadn't, but that's what I think it's done. We can talk about procedures for that de novo hearing, but in terms of reading the statutory definition, and I say rightly so, but let's say rightly or wrongly, if the commission rightly or wrongly had that outcome of warning, if it were wrongly, it's still a sanction under Chapter 33 de novo review. If it was rightly or wrongly, it's still under the Chapter 33 a sanction. That's the review that brings us here. Not at our urging. This is not the commission saying, please give me another trial. Judge Keller, under the Constitution, has no right of appellate review under the statute, under the rules. Rule 9 doesn't apply because this was from a pre-formal proceeding. Rule 10 gives no appellate review for this. In the Genovine case, Judge Genovine said, where's my appellate review? Constitution didn't give it, statute didn't give it, rules didn't give it. The legislature amended the statute to give appellate review where there not used to not be any, and in doing that has made a policy choice based on the name of the outcome. Is it a censure? This kind. Is it a warning? This kind.
Is E1 constitutional?
I'm sorry?
E1 of 33034?
I don't think it could not be. That is, I think the power of the legislature to grant review is an extra right to a judge rather than constraining any of the rights or procedures that are set forth in the Constitution. Chief Justice Livingston, I have not thought through that and briefed it. I'm just feel so confident with that answer, but if that's an important matter to the court, I'd be happy to be briefing the constitutionality of E1 and E2.
No, right. That's fine. But I am curious. It sounds like we have two competing interests in both the Constitution, the statutes, and the rules, and that is to balance the need to protect the public against an accused judge's rights for due process. So I wonder, how can it be due process to give a prosecutorial type environment a do-over?
My wife used to be the prosecutor for a little suburb of Austin, and they got do-overs on their Class A misdemeanors, and the do-overs were never welcome to that little municipality because they couldn't afford going over to county court at law. But that's the legislative choice, and it is not a do-over
that
the commission asked for.
But do you know why that is? Because there's no court reporter in JP court, and it's a financial thing. Do you want to have a court reporter transcribe thousands of traffic tickets, or do you want to just allow those rare few get a do-over in county court? Here we have a record of all of the proceedings, so it doesn't make any sense then that you would have an entirely new de novo proceeding before other fact finders. It's illogical unless you interpret the Constitution in the way that Mr. Pat Babcock interprets it, which is to say, if you have an investigatory phase, which would be pre-formal hearing, pre-court reporter stage, then you get your sanction. Or you have your formal hearing with your court reporter and your evidence and all of that, and then you're limited to censure. And then if it's a censure, you have a review of the record. But if it's a sanction, because there was never a court reporter, it was just an investigation, then you get your trial de novo in front of the special court of review. That makes complete sense to me.
It does to me.
It doesn't make complete sense to me that the commission gets to have an entire evidentiary hearing and then gets to just do the entire thing over again because it labeled it a sanction. It doesn't sound right. It doesn't feel right.
And I want to work on each of those pieces.
Okay.
Because feel right is important to justices serving justice.
And it's not. Doing and right feel is right important. Isn't anywhere in there.
It is important.
But it's illogical is a better way of phrasing it. It's not logical to me.
You remember that accidentally Mr. Babcock suggested earlier that the nature of review was within the Constitution, which it is not. That is, when we consider the Constitution, the proper construction of the Constitution has to be done without knowing what will the legislature one day say about appellate things. The constitutional construction doesn't turn on did the legislature later make a good policy division line or a bad one. It turns on what are the powers of a commission whose job, spelled out in paragraphs 1 to 6 of that provision, is devoted to the public, while giving due process rights to the judge, and who have the power, we say, to do a variety of things that include leniency and warnings. And nothing says if you give more process, then the judge is not entitled to and the commission doesn't have the power to do more lenient. Nothing in the Constitution says you cannot be lenient at the outcome, depending on the evidence and the decisions. Nothing in the Constitution. But to construe the Constitution, we can't go and say, what would the legislature one day decide about its appellate choices? Because the constitutional language was there before the legislature had any censure de novo, deferential review. The constitutional language preceded the legislature's choice that we're going to make this kind of appeal from this outcome and this kind from that outcome. I wish the legislature had made different choices or different dividing lines. But that doesn't guide the construction of the Constitution. The power of the Constitution was reviewed by the Supreme Court in promulgating rules, and it has a very commonsensical outcome that the word or didn't mean either or you can't do anything else. that the last sentence that did not purport to deprive any outcomes implicitly and quietly took away lots of outcomes for the good of the people of Texas and for the judge, a more lenient outcome. Nothing in the Constitution says that, but I share the frustration. And
acting as though that's good for the judge, that she only got a sanction, and on the one hand, sure, that's nice. On the other hand, and your prize is you get a trial de novo and have to present all of your witnesses all over again, and according to the government code, be subject to a greater or a lesser sanction from our court, from our special court of review, if we rule it that way. So that's not really a big prize to get this sanction as opposed to something else, because if she'd gotten even a censure, then at least we would just be reviewing the record rather than her having to go through an entire evidentiary trial again. And when we interpret the Constitution and rules, as you know, we are to do so in a manner that doesn't lead to an absurd result. And I keep using the word illogical, not fair. But the technical term is that it doesn't lead us to an absurd consequence. And that's my concern with what you're proposing, is that it's leading us to an absurd consequence.
Let's test that. It is in Judge Keller's power to say, I offer into evidence pages 1 through 950 of the transcript below. And for the evidentiary record, that's my burden of proof, for me to offer, for her not to object, for us to cooperate in putting in. But the legislature says de novo, which means there needs to be evidence in front of this panel. But it doesn't have to be a do-over. That's a choice Judge Keller can try if she wishes to have different witnesses or not, to rely on the prior record. The mere fact that it's de novo means, as I understand the statute, that there has to be this panel receiving evidence and making a decision as if no one else had made this decision before. That's what de novo means in each of the times that you've reviewed these things as they came up from justice to county court. That doesn't mean we have to have a four-day trial. It means there's the power to. There's the power if one wishes, but that's not my dream. I'd have no belief that that's Mr. Babcock's dream. But that the efficiency with which it can be done is a matter of presentation. The legislative choice of de novo, I wish it weren't. I think it is. I understand the fairness issue that you're addressing. I emphasize every time I hear that the commission wants a do-over, the commission did not ask for any appeal. We are responding to an appeal, and we're following the best we can the law under the legislative choice of what this appeal looks like. And I know that's the purpose of everybody, is to follow the legislative process for what this appeal is. I want to talk about two other things, if I may, and I appreciate walking through this, and we'll come right back to this if that's helpful. I want to talk about the word void. I think we can comb back and forth through Mr. Babcock's brief and find that he's mistaken when he says he cited cases that if a tribunal orders broader remedy relief than they had power to, that it's void. I don't find that in their brief. I think that if we look through the cases, we find two kinds of instances of void. One is mandated by the Constitution. It doesn't apply here. When a decision maker, when a judge has a personal financial interest or a consanguinity with a party, it is unwaivable, it is constitutional, that is a void outcome. And that's it. Other frailties about a judge, and there are cases about a judge who stayed as a district judge longer than term, hadn't resided in the county, other things, they are not void. That is, they are voidable, they are waivable if not objected to at the proper time. But that's void when we're talking about a decision maker is not a question of whether somebody is in the right geographic area or not, whether somebody held over under the constitutional provision to wait for Governor Perry to appoint the successor. None of those cases. Void is a conflict of interest, and there's none suggested here. There's one other place that void comes up. The MAPCO Supreme Court case is what we had cited. I think McEachern is similar. There are a variety of them, and they say this. When the subject matter isn't even there, the examples that repeatedly are given in the cases, a county court doing a divorce or a county court determining title to land, there's just no subject matter. Those are the two times of void. In the reply brief, there's not a word about void. In the original brief of Judge Keller, there's nothing suggesting the case law that contradicts what I've just described to you, the two kinds of things, neither of which is here. Here there was subject matter jurisdiction, no question. Judge Keller's a judge. This commission has power for disciplinary issues, subject matter jurisdiction. So what's the consequence of that? A de novo trial, simply, all that happened before goes away. We cited two cases related to this topic in our briefing. One is the Kamenetsky case. In Kamenetsky, the party said, I objected to Judge so-and-so, I think it was Humboldt or a similar name, I objected to that judge, and the Justice of the Peace Court didn't recuse and disqualify, and I had a proper basis for that, and the Court of Appeals, reviewing the county court decision, the de novo decision, says, well, that is, and they use the word moot, because it is. What happened in the earlier tribunal about the quality of who was the judge is moot because we're reviewing the county court, the de novo tribunal. That's the Kamenetsky case. The other is called Stafford. In Stafford, and both are cited in our briefing, in the Stafford case, there was a constitutional dimension objection that the JP court violated due process issues. And it then went to the county court, de novo, and the reviewing Court of Appeal says it matters not what occurred in the justice court given the de novo trial conducted by the county court. And so the point that I urge is suppose an outcome was erroneous, was not an authorized outcome. Well, the de novo court addresses only authorized outcomes. Suppose Judge Fields should have left without waiting for his successor, even though the Constitution begs that there be holdover until the appointment. Suppose that's wrong. The de novo court cures that. Suppose Justice Patterson, despite two attorney general opinions saying it was right, we put in our appendix the 2004 and 2006 attorney general opinion, informal letters, one before the constitutional amendment in 2005, another one afterwards, saying there was no problem with this composition. The executive director asked the attorney general to consider it, no problem. But if there were, if this, you don't even reach the issue. It's moot, is what you would say, because now we have a de novo tribunal.
Well, we've got a little bit different situation here in that the commission gets to act as prosecutor and judge. They made the choice. They could have rendered a public warning before they instituted the formal proceedings. They had that option. But yet they decided to institute formal proceedings and go for the good cause for the greater sanction. Doesn't the Constitution provide that if you make that gamble and you make that choice and you go down that road, your only option is to find good cause and issue one of the three provisions in the Constitution under 1A8. Not, your only other option is to dismiss at that point.
You've heard my arguments on that, and they either persuade or do not persuade. The last sentence of paragraph 8 does not have language that says these are limited outcomes. If they did, one of the specified outcomes would be dismissal. It does not have any words of delimitation, and that's what I have urged to. But in terms of gamble, a fair observation of this is that the full light of day with cross-examination powers by Judge Keller could show that this should have been dismissed. Giving this was not a gamble of can we do more. Giving this was serving the public on serious allegations about the highest face of criminal justice in Texas, who, according to her own testimony, in the informal investigation and again at trial, says, given the same things, I'd do it again. I knew it was mandatory. I knew it was death penalty. I knew I wasn't the assigned judge. I knew there was one. I knew from the email I saw at 2:40 in the afternoon that something was expected. All those things that finding out were those or were those not the facts, was there some explanation, was the explanation, I was distracted, I feel so badly about this, I didn't know that rule, it wasn't something that I was aware of. Every opportunity, not to gamble, but to let the public know an outcome on an important matter, because one outcome could be dismissal. One outcome could be recommendation of removal. One outcome could be censure. One could be warning. One could be reprimand. And from a full evidentiary record, 12 people who are good citizens to this state, including lay people, judges, and two lawyers, 12 distinguished people appointed by the Supreme Court, the legislature, and two of them by the Bar Association, made the 19-page order that has been shown to you, which by this process, I believe, is reviewed de novo and is substituted with the outcome by this panel. Thank you very much for hearing. Yes, Justice Alcala.
I'm sorry, I asked Judge Livingston for permission. If I could ask just one question that you haven't talked about and that's on my mind, so I wanted to just ask it. Is it proper for us to consider Ms. Shauna Willing's statements to the Texas lawyer? And what is your explanation about those statements? Because she seems to have said the exact opposite of what you've told us here today.
I think that's correct. And she co-signs. Her name is on this brief with mine. She has authorized this brief. To my knowledge, this is the first briefing that she has participated on this issue. The emails are not quoted with quotation marks in Ms. Robbins' article, but I think the gist is fairly reported in those articles. One could quibble. I've read the emails. They're not part of this record. But the question would be, Justice Alcala, whether one construes constitutional provisions and statutes and rules by news communication snippets or by the briefing, the textual, the looking at principles of construction. And this, which I believe is the first time these issues have been briefed by Ms. Willing or by me, if you think that her snippets reported without quotations in the media are more persuasive, you do as you wish. But if you are looking to common construction of important words, I suggest that the Supreme Court's construction 18 years ago is a very reasonable reading of that constitutional provision, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McKetta. All right, we'll proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You'll have 15 minutes, and I believe you get a two-minute warning.
Thank you very much. The symmetry of Mr. McKetta complaining about news snippets being used is ironic, given the fact that the charges against Judge Keller emanated from those very same news snippets, as Judge Bershelman found, were based on lies propagated by the Texas Defender Service. It's not so much that her comments are in a newspaper any more than the fact that for years, judges in this state have been told by the commission, not in the newspaper, but in a formal commission document, and go to the part on the right, that there are two tracks, and that if formal charges are filed, then only three things can happen. Mr. McKetta, I think, is quite wrong when he says that the Constitution doesn't provide for the dismissal option. Of course, it does. If you look at the Constitution, subsection 5, it says that recommendations for retirement, censure, suspension, or removal shall be by the affirmative vote of at least seven members. And if seven members don't vote for that, then they can't do what they're trying to do. Justice Alcala, you asked about a criminal analogy, and I just happen to have someone at hand who knows something about the criminal law. And it is suggested that in the criminal context, if Judge Keller was acquitted by the commission because they didn't have seven votes finding good cause to censure her, and their only option under the Constitution and statutes was to dismiss the charges. Instead, they did the equivalent of assessing a fine after they acquitted her. And had that occurred in the criminal context, that would have been void, and a judgment of acquittal would have been the proper remedy. Mr. Maketa says that we don't have to have a do-over. We don't have to have a do-over. That's Judge Keller's choice. Well, that's preposterous. The reason Judge Bershelman found the way he did was because he was able to observe David Dow try to support the lies that he had told the press about Judge Keller. The reason why Judge Bershelman found the way he did was because after looking the witnesses and seeing them and hearing how their stories matched up and the demeanor of the witnesses, found as he did, it is amazing to suggest that because of what the commission has done, that Judge Keller now has to give up her right to a trial and just let you guys look at a barren record devoid of emotion, credibility, or an ability to look at the witnesses. When he says it's Judge Keller's problem with respect to the do-over, she, after all, invoked the appellate process. Well, he forgets, of course, that we did file a mandamus seeking to raise these issues, and the commission took the position that the Supreme Court was without jurisdiction because we had an adequate right of appeal to you all. Mr. Maketa also forgets, in talking about this de novo right that is so good in his view, that with the trial we had in front of Judge Bershelman, we had a trial, we had findings, and we had an appellate type right if there had been a censure. But in this proceeding, we have no appellate rights. It's over after you all decide. So our right to appeal is taken away from us, even though Judge Keller is exposed to, as you pointed out, more severe sanctions. She doesn't have an appeal. So this isn't...
Sorry, I'm not following you. If it had been a censure, I thought it still came to the special court
That's right.
of review. And
That's
then
right.
you're saying there'd be an appeal after that?
No. But you would have been judging a trial record. In other words, we had a trial. The judge made findings. There would have been an appellate review of that trial record.
Right.
But now, the way they're trying to do it, you wipe out that trial record. We create a new trial record with you, but there is no appeal from that other than on a federal constitutional issue to the United States Supreme Court.
Can you explain to the panel what the difference would be if this court were to find that the order issued was merely erroneous as opposed to void?
Well, it is void, and we've cited a couple of cases, Klein versus Niblo, a Texas Supreme Court case, and Fulton versus Finch. And I don't, unless you want me to, don't need to read the sound bites from them, but there are, they say that it's void. But whether it's void or erroneous, the consequence is the same. They can't do what they're trying to do. They can't get a trial de novo. And they can't get an appeal because there is no censure.
And that's where I think you might lose me. If it's, I'm undecided. Let me say that. I don't
sure.
want to make it sound as though I've reached any decision. I've been trying to figure out how to interpret all of these things and how to make them consistent if they can be.
Right.
Void, to me, would lead to the result of a dismissal.
Yes.
Erroneous, to me, leads to the result of a trial, whether it's de novo or by record, but erroneous would mean trial of some sort.
Well,
but you don't see it that way?
I don't see how it can be if it's de novo, Judge, because if it's de novo, it wipes out everything that's gone before. It's just like a JP judge may have made all sorts of errors.
Right, but you're saying it's void. And
it
if
is.
We agree with you that it's void, then I think you're right.
Right.
Then it's dismissal.
Right.
But if we say we agree with, well, you're not saying it's erroneous. That's your second choice. But let's say we agree. We thought it was erroneous, but not void. We can only reach that decision once we've had a trial of some sort, whether it's de novo or by a record.
I disagree, Your Honor. Courts all the time reverse and render.
But I mean, that's after a proceeding of some sort. We don't disregard the proceeding and just make a ruling. We have a proceeding. People file briefs. We read the record, and then we reverse and we render. We
right.
don't do that before we have a hearing. We have to have the hearing.
Well, you're having a hearing. We're for
well,
sure.
Well, this
here.
Is a hearing on a motion to dismiss.
Right.
This is not a hearing on the merits of the litigation.
But we are saying, as a matter of law, this commission has exceeded its authority under the Constitution. We think the cases say that because they've done that, their ruling is void. I think the court agrees that if you reach that conclusion, then the dismissal is appropriate. I don't know in terms of labeling it whether you want to label it something else, but you have before you everything you need to determine whether the commission erred in exceeding its authority. You know, because it's not contested, that they instituted formal proceedings. You know that they issued a public warning. You know, despite the Herculean machinations to try to talk about rules versus statutes and back to the Constitution, that Ms. Willing's comments in the Texas Lawyer and the chart that the commission has are exactly right. They only had three choices: dismissal, censure, or recommendation of removal. It's all the choices they had. You know all those things. The Genovine case was brought up by counsel, and it is instructive because Judge Genovine made the argument that I think you may be struggling with, Judge, and that is, he said, this just doesn't make sense. You know, it's right in the opinion. He said, the court said, we acknowledge it may seem counterintuitive that a judge would have a right to appeal by special court of review for lesser sanctions, but have no right to appeal for the more serious censure. This was before the Constitution was amended in 2005. This is a 2003 case. But the court went on to say, we've got to take it as we find it. And the Constitution says what it says, and the legislature says what it says, and we have to implement those. We can't go rewriting the Constitution. We can't go rewriting the statutes, even though to us it doesn't make sense. Frankly, the statutory scheme that they've created here does make a little bit of sense. In fact, in your comments to Mr. Maketa, you recognize that, Justice Sotomayor, I think, because if there is a sanction, the lesser bad thing that can be done for a judge, then there is a trial de novo in front of a three-judge panel, and you decide the facts and the law, and that's the end of it, unless there's a constitutional issue, as there was in the Heck case, in which case it could go to the U.S. Supreme Court. But in the more serious situation, where formal proceedings have been instituted, and formal charges have been made, and a trial has been held, and a record has been created, the commission just does not have the ability to go back to the other track, wipe out the trial, and force Judge Keller to a new trial with new expense and take away her right to appeal.
What about this court's authority to render the decision the trial court should have rendered, which is a fairly standard appellate rule that we apply in reviewing cases?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. That's something that you can do and should do, because here we know that the commission should have dismissed the charges because they didn't have seven votes, the seven votes that the Constitution required them to have. You should tell them they did the wrong thing. They should have dismissed. They can't do this public warning. And Frank, and one thing I kept hearing and I'm trying not to let my ears burn too much, about how the Texas Supreme Court has for 12 years lived with Rule 10M or something. I think Your Honor pointed out the inconsistency with 10M, even with Rule 1 of the rules. But the Constitution has been amended since 10M was applied, and as chair of the committee, I can tell you we haven't talked about these rules in the 10 years I've been there, and the Supreme Court has got plenty on its plate trying to discipline lawyers or not, and it's never brought this up, and I promise you that it hasn't been thought of, certainly hasn't been the subject of an opinion before the Supreme Court in that time. So to suggest that the Supreme Court has somehow sanctioned a rule that is in conflict, as even the examiner admits, with the Constitution, and that you should base a ruling on it, it seems to me is not appropriate. Have I answered everybody's questions?
I believe so.
Everybody got the answers?
All right.
It may be a tougher question.
Thank you, Mr. Babcock.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate
your
time.
Thank you, Mr. McKetta. Yes, and if counsel would remain, we're going to adjourn court, and then we'll come back in and talk about some of our calendaring issues.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
All rise.